Military Mountains Mortgage. I have with me today Mark Hoffmeister. So accomplished, and this intro won't even be able to begin to encapsulate it all. So I'm just going to go with the important things that I value. So, Mark, you're a husband, father, athlete, very accomplished athlete, a retired U.S. Army colonel, recipient of Bronze Star, Purple Heart, Ranger qualified, Sapper qualified, and I feel like those are probably my top ones. But your heart and the admiration I have for you is why we're here today. And so, without further ado, who is Mark Hoffmeister?
Well, thanks, Brian. I'm not sure how to start with that simple intro. Geez. Nowadays, Mark is a regular guy who is finally having the opportunity to enjoy life.
Cool. I like that. Nice. Well, like I said, retired U.S. Army colonel, full bird colonel. For the civilians listening, you commanded brigades of soldiers. So what's that? Upwards of probably 600 troops?
4,000.
I was thinking battalion. Yeah, 4,000. Yeah, that's right. So 4,000, that's a lot of people to to command. So yeah, I guess really I wanted to start just kind of at the beginning. Obviously, your military service is interesting to me. But I kind of want to, what I've been doing with the podcast recently too, is just kind of give tidbits to other people and people listening of like what it takes. And so what does it take for a young person in our country right now to apply to and get accepted to West Point?
It takes full commitment and understanding of, what a career service may entail. You know, I applaud anyone who is considering pursuing military service, and there's obviously different levels of it. You know, when I applied to, I went to West Point, graduated in 1992. So yeah, dating myself.
Class of 92.
Class of 92, the brave and the few for those out there listening. But even then, during the application process, it was extremely limiting. You know, there were some 1,100, 1,200 students that were accepted out of around, I think it was 30 to 40,000 applicants.
Holy, I didn't realize it was
so,
that much.
So significant. And then, you know, on top of that, you lay on the academic limits, you are, you know, requirements, qualifications, you lay on the need for, you know, congressional nominations, you lay on the physical fitness requirements in order to do that. And every one of those is a filter that just starts eliminating those who may be interested. So it's not something that really comes somewhat spontaneously. Maybe I shouldn't say that. If you have lived a life where you are cultivating and developing yourself, then the attributes are there that allow that path to be open to you.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you suddenly come to the realization that you want to do some, this can be for, I guess, any kind of large goal. If you haven't already laid the foundation, it's kind of hard to catch up. So yeah, I mean, I was, as a kid, you know, I graduated second in my class. I had been very involved in, frankly, the martial arts. I was helping, I ran a dojo. Okay. I started teaching at like 15, 16, was competing amateur then professionally in the martial arts throughout my high school.
Okay.
And all of those things had laid a foundation that just aligned with service, the whole structure that, you know, ended up calling to me. And it didn't really call to me until midway through high school.
So why West Point? Did you have a mentor or somebody kind of exposed you to that? Or because you could have just gone the traditional OCS route or like college route or whatever, but why West Point?
So that was a little bit of soul searching. Originally I wanted to go to the Air Force Academy. I was all wrapped up and it would be really cool to fly planes and all this stuff and be a jet pilot. And then, I started going through the process, started learning these things. You know, the main reason I pursued, the academies, and I did look at all, ROTC stuff too, was because I had watched my parents, you know, pay to put my sisters through college.
Okay.
And I did not want to place that burden on them. I wanted to figure out a different path. So I started looking at different options. I'd pursued a different couple of scholarships, but in the process, I started learning all of the opportunities that were available. And it was illuminating, you know, the experience that could be there. As I was going through the Air Force application process, you know, they found a stigmatism in my eye and they're like, yeah, well, you may not be a pilot, you may be a navigator. I'm like, whoa. Yeah, I'm not backseating. not something I'm after. And so I started broadening the aperture. Okay. I had three ROTC scholarships. I had gotten accepted at the Naval Academy and at West Point. I had congressional nominations to all three. And then I lost one because they found out that I already had another to another academy. So, because you have to have a congressional member who nominates you in order to attend.
Okay.
But when I did some soul searching and thought about who is Mark and what do I really enjoy doing, I spent a lot of time as a kid. My dad would, you know, we'd go out, we did, you know, some hiking and climbing in the Northeast, did a bit of hunting, that kind of stuff. And I was always comfortable in the woods. It was my only frame of reference. I didn't have any immediate family service members. There was no real role models in school. In fact, I was the first student of Nauset High School to ever attend West Point.
Oh, wow. Where's that?
That's actually in on Cape Cod.
All right.
Yeah. So I was there for my last 2 years of high school. I grew up in the west side of the state of Massachusetts in Pittsfield, Mass, and then moved out to Cape Cod for the last 2 years, which is where the whole application process went. Yeah, but end of the day, I decided that West Point sounded great, and you know, I started looking at what it was to serve, and originally wanted to be an infantryman because it was, you know, all high speed and
naturally,
all this cool stuff. And then, as I went through the academy, I learned a whole lot more about the different branches of the Army.
Yep.
And I learned that I was an engineering student to begin with. I was an aerospace major at West Point, mechanical engineer. And, you know, I had a proclivity in that area and I'm like, well, you know, I mean, engineering, that's a good job. I can go to West Point. I can serve my 5-year requirement and then I can get out and I can get a really good job as an engineer.
Yeah.
You know, because engineers are smart. And I was like, but wait a minute, engineers, they also have this thing called combat engineering. Mm-hmm. You get to, you know, blow things up. You get to do all the kind of cool stuff the infantry guys do, but they also get to build things. I'm like, wow, I can kind of do all of it.
Yeah.
And so I migrated that way and that was the start of my path.
When do you branch? Okay. So for your program, do you branch?
So you branch in your senior year.
Okay.
And it's all based upon, and if I say anything wrong to the new processes out there, I'm obviously dated, but, it's all based upon what your class rank is and what the availability of, the positions that are, there are allocations.
True
for every
needs
type
of the
branch,
Army.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually, later in my career, I was involved in talent management for the engineer regiment, so I've got a pretty good understanding of the way that we select and how many slots are going to go to the academies versus different colleges and how we gain that diversity, which is really, it's essential to the strength of our force to have that cognitive diversity across the force, so you have to draw them from multiple different commissioning sources.
Okay. Dude, that's super interesting. All right. So you graduate West Point, combat engineer. I am in full agreement. I'm an engineer as well. Fort Leonard Wood for basic, basic AIT.
Home of the engineers, for those who don't know that.
It's awesome place. It's in the Ozarks in the woods of Missouri. I look back on that like super fondly. I'm pretty similar. I decided to join the Army out of, you know, my parents were going through it financially at the time. They were dealing with some stuff with my older siblings and their college experiences and just the cost of that. And I'm like, yeah, I don't want to saddle them with that. So I was like, same thing. I'll have the Army pay for college and go at it that way. But then I showed up at Leonard Wood. You know, I'm a small town kid from Conifer, Colorado. And I had never left Colorado ever. And same thing, grew up in the woods. As soon as I hit the woods of Fort Leonard Wood, I'm like, this is the coolest thing ever. I'm like, I get paid to go train and, you know, ruck march and obstacle courses and all the BRM, all the weapons stuff. And it was just too much fun. And then once I graduated basic and got into the engineer field, I'm like, oh, now I know what this is as well. And I graduated right around the initial invasion of Iraq. And so the unit that I was assigned to was a part of the initial push. And so the engineers were right alongside the infantry pushing into Iraq, you know, pushing up berm or taking down berm or taking down obstacles, doing the whole thing. And I just fell in love with the engineer field right off the bat. So I'd imagine as soon as you graduated platoon in an engineer company somewhere, platoon leader?
Yeah, well, I, you know, this your unit selection as well as your branch is also something that is based upon your class rank and all that, and highly competitive for some of the slots. And so, yeah, my first duty station was I wanted to get to the 13th Engineer Battalion, which is a combat light unit. I've always wanted to be, you know, kind of light airborne, and that's what I ended up doing for the majority of my career. I ended up getting the 14th Engineer Battalion at Fort Ord, there was a slot that opened up into the 13th, which was awesome. Nice. Because I went through the pipeline to go into the 13th, and it was a matter of circumstances that I ended up going to the 14th, which was a mech wheeled unit. But in order to go into a light unit at the time, those positions were ranger coded, so I had to go to ranger school. So immediately coming out of West Point, went to ranger school. I was already sapper qualified. I'd already gotten that while a cadet, which is really what sealed the deal for me going into the engineers. As a cadet, as a cow or a junior, went through. It was the first time that they put cadets through the sapper leader course. This is in 1990.
Cool.
15% graduation rate. So it was a tough class. It was illuminating. And it was a good train up for ranger school right afterwards. So I went to ranger school, which as a requirement set the conditions for me to be able to interview and apply to a job, to get into the 13th, which I was excited for. I was out at Fort Ord. Fort Ord was closing and 9th Infantry Regiment was moving up to Fort Lewis, which the 13th Engineer Battalion was a part of. And during that whole process was also the buildup in the and everything that was going on in Somalia in 1992-93, and the position came open in the 13th that needed to be filled in really in prep for that deployment. I interviewed, got that job, and started doing what I really liked as a sapper platoon leader. It was
awesome.
It was amazing. So.
Training your guys, being out there. Fort Lewis is fun. I like that post.
I loved Fort Lewis. Yeah. Love the Northwest. Loved everything about it. Definitely gave me a taste. Army blessed me. You know, they kept pushing me, you know, to the mountains, which is why I'm now living in Colorado too.
So. Yeah. So again, as an engineer, I've had this soft spot in my heart for sapper school. And when I was in AIT, we shared a DFACT with all the, sapper students, and man, they were coming in there every day just beat to hell. So context for the listeners, about how many starts a sapper class, and then like you said, a 15% graduation, how many kind of finish?
Oh, I don't know the exact numbers. The classes are definitely pretty small. It's a 30-day course, and it's very intensive. It's basically split. So really the first half of it is focused on general subjects, which are all the type of duties and responsibilities that a light combat engineer does to support light infantry in contact. So that's improvised, explosive devices, it's breaching drills, it's navigation, patrolling, how to lay in an explosive ambush, all those kind of things. And then the last two go into your patrolling phases. So you then take all of those skills, and then you apply them during patrols, and they do you do some pretty other wild stuff. You do helicasting, you learn how to rig on it, rig stuff up for helicopter operations, sling loading, all that kind of stuff. Very similar to what you do during air assault.
Yeah, sling load's so fun. It's being under a bird, hooking up like that, and wanting off for the static lecture scene. Just all the steps.
Have you ever helicasted?
What is that exactly?
Oh, so that's a low-level water entry out the back of a CH-47s.
No.
Yeah, and then you got to basically swim your ruck into shore and all that kind of stuff. So
nice. Yeah, it looks fun. I mean, that's all the recruiting films or all the recruiting commercials.
Oh, it's
right?
All, you know, it's all the fun stuff that combat engineers get to do packed into 30 days of vacation.
Yeah. And then to become Ranger qualified, again, a very ambitious, arduous journey. Again, pretty high attrition, not a ton of people graduate. Obviously, throughout the force, there's plenty of Ranger qualified soldiers, but you know, that's a very hard one. Kind of walk me through Ranger school. What's that like?
Ranger school, again, you made the comment earlier about getting paid to do these things. People may call me crazy, but you know, I got paid to go to Ranger school, which to me, I love it because, you know, Ranger school, environmentally based phases, so you're doing almost the same type light infantry tactics, raid, recon, ambush, these types of things that the infantry do, but you're doing them in different environments. Back in the day when I did this, back in 92, they had a desert phase. So you have a desert phase, a bedding phase, a mountain phase, and a Florida or swamp phase.
Okay.
So as environmental conditions change, as terrain changes, tactics change somewhat, obviously. Yeah. And, you know, so you just have to adapt to that. But what I love about Ranger School and what I think is it kind of has always fit with part of my personality is that it breaks you down to those visceral elements as a team and as an individual of, you know, of what you have left. You know, it grinds you down and challenges you to rise up in the face of difficulty. Yeah. And to do so as a team. I think it shaped, I had a lot of that experiences from early on in the way that I was training in the martial arts. Cool. Very similar type mentality of, you know, push yourself, challenge yourself, you know, bear the essence and then see what comes out. But then the team concept of recognizing when, you know, a person has got to take a knee and you need to maybe shift some weight out of their rucksack, pick up, carry on, et cetera, in order to accomplish the mission as a team. I think it's very shaping to make, you know, Rangers who they are, whether just qualified or serving in the regiment. You know, they're the elite of our military. And a lot of that is the mindset to do what is necessary to accomplish the mission, and also to do what is necessary to, you know, never leave a fallen comrade. Yeah. And that has definitely guided my philosophy, probably in almost everything I do.
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, I've, you know, later years where we used to, my wife and I had we were sponsored as an adventure racing team for several years. And for those who aren't familiar with adventure racing, that's a multi-day stage, multi-sport event. So, you know, you just continue to move nonstop 24-hour race for, could be 3 days, could be 10 days. You could start off in, you know, orienteering, go into mountain bike and go into water navigation.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like doing a patrol in Ranger school. It breaks everybody down to the core essence, and you go through all the emotions that a human has, and you got to work together as a team to accomplish a goal.
Yeah. But there's something different about working with the guys and working with your wife.
Yeah, well, there absolutely is. So, you know, a funny story that you bring that up. So a good buddy of mine, Bob Haynes, he's actually a firefighter down in Colorado Springs, a retired infantryman. And he raced with us on the team as well. And, you know, I always referred to him as a team sergeant because, you know, I would come up with the stupid ideas and he would tell me they were stupid. So it was always valuable to have him on the team. But he was also the surrogate husband because as we were racing, whenever we hit, you know, we start hitting some tension points. I was usually the primary navigator and had to focus on route selection and all that. And, of course, my wife would be like, Are you lost? Are you sure we're going the right way? I'm like, well, you can take the map. You know, it was always a funny conversation, but whenever she, you know, was emotionally tense, which we all did, I'm not saying it was just her. We all went through this, but you know, I didn't have time to do what a husband would do for her in a race. I was trying to lead the team. And so I'd be like, Bob, and Bob be like, all right, Gail, you have 5 minutes, cry now. Yeah. You know, and she's like, okay. Yeah, she's an amazingly tough woman and unbelievably skilled racer in that. It was always fun. Great experiences.
Yeah. No, that's super cool because then you like, obviously, romantic interests and that's your partner. That's your mate, right? But then to also see your partner achieve and strive for that super physically demanding and mentally demanding outcome together, I think it's awesome. Yeah. Like, you could go to couples counseling or you could maybe do an adventure race together.
Well, we call it. We actually call it, you know, trail time is marital counseling. We joke about that all the time. And, you know, that part of our relationship is a core to who we are. It probably is why I'm still alive today because it got me through when I was wounded. You know, the way that we have this bond, she pulled me out of some dark times, kept me walking. But yeah, we would always joke in things like adventure racing that you literally go through every stage of a relationship. You know, you're all giddy and excited at the start of the race. It's like you're newlyweds, you know, and things get strained. You start arguing, you know, everything gets distraught. Then, you know, halfway through, we're like, I'm done. We get divorced, you know, and then and then all of a sudden we rekindle it. And by the time we come off the finish line, we're, you know, we're back together and happy. So.
Oh, and then when you finish, is there any better feeling? You're just on cloud nine together. And
Yep. And then you go through the post-race depression together too. So yeah.
When's our next one? Yeah. Like,
have we signed up yet?
Yeah. Cause you just trained and you just went to the peak, right? You just went through all that together. And
yeah,
that's so funny. The post-race depression.
Yeah. And we've done that with, you know, adventure racing, with our climbing, with, yeah. And now we're doing it together as we figure out our retirement together. Yeah. It's a whole nother path, which is fun.
How many years have you been married?
So we were married in, gonna do the math, 95. So, wow, this is a big year.
Your 30th
year. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Coming right up.
That is so cool. 30 years. That gives me something to look forward to. I think I found my wife, same thing. She's super strong mentally and physically. We've done some good trips into the mountains together and, our goal, we were just talking the other day, our goals is to be able to be in the woods as much as possible one day when we're retired. So I'm going to look to you and I'm going to call you one day and be like, you got any tips? So
yeah, we'll just bring you on trail with us.
Yeah, that too. So, and I think that's, you touched on something earlier and before we move too far off of it, I wanted to highlight that. I think when the average person, the ordinary citizen thinks of the special operations community and the peaks that is the military, SEALs, Rangers, SF, all those guys, that maybe people would think that that's individualistic or, you know, you've got all these type A personalities, you're the peak there, but you touched on it about the leadership, about the team mentality of like, hey, Brian's kind of fallen back here on this patrol. What can Mark do to bring me up? And I've always understood Ranger School to really be a leadership school. Do you have any tips for anybody really, military, civilian alike, on building that cohesive team? And I know this is broad, but like when the going gets tough, what is just a tried and true way to bring up that team member that just needs a little extra oomph?
Yeah. Well, it is a broad question, but you know, at the very core, it's trust and empathy. You know, and there needs to be a recognition that it's not about you. As I've, you know, transitioned from the military and entered into, you know, the civilian world, there's a very different perspective that way. Because it's a rare organization that truly cultivates the team in the way that the military does. You know, I think every service member recognizes that they have to trust the man or woman on their left or right with their life. They don't know. And this, it doesn't even have to be when bullets are flying. It's the maintenance of your vehicle. It's whether your helicopter flies safely. It's any of these things. Your lives are mutually integrated. If you can transfer that perspective to, you know, that part of whatever organizational team you are a part of, and take away those attributes that allow you to understand how interrelated you are, then you see that, you know, it's not a matter of you. It's a matter of we. It's not a matter of, well, you're doing too much work. Well, maybe you're doing too much work right now because somebody else needs you to take that load. And guess what? Next week, you know, when something has happened in your life or you've had to take a back seat, that person's going to pick up your load. You know, there's this homeostasis that has to be maintained within a team, and it's never about balance or equality. You know, it's equilibrium.
Equal. Okay. All right. I like that. Yeah. I mean, in the civilian world, there's just so many directions teams get pulled, you know, maternity, paternity leave, like people have kids constantly. You can, at the end of the day, be fired. It's a little harder to get fired in the military, in the army, but you know, one thing that the army does do is coach and mentor and retrain. Like there's, sure. You know, Brian needs more training. You know, Mark's going to train me and do that. Sometimes in the civilian world, it's a little harder to do that because there's a profit motive and things need to be done, you know, in order. If you just can't pull your weight, you can be let go. But the leaders who get the most out of their organizations understand how to, in that kind of white space time, like in between projects or whatever, hey, let's maybe plus Mark up in this arena. So. Yeah. I really love how the Army can flow into the civilian sector, and how the things we learned in the military, that lead those leadership principles, we can enhance organizations in the civilian sector.
Sure.
So for all the transitioning military out there that are going to find themselves in the civilian world, you will be utilized. You just don't know it yet. So
yeah.
All right. So then, you know, obviously started knocking off the schools, airborne, aerosol, ranger, sapper, all those things, which, you know, when I was a young soldier, when I looked to my officers, seeing you tabbed out like that was just like the coolest thing to me. So I'm like, okay, that guy's going to lead me somewhere. He's been through all the things. But your first few deployments, kind of walk me through that. I think you went to Somalia back in the day?
So no, ended up not. We were all lined up to deploy to Somalia. In fact, we were backfilling 10th Mountain into Somalia when, for those of you who refer to it as Black Hawk Town, you know, when October happened and we lost the Rangers, and there was a significant change in policy. So, you know, we stood down off of that deployment and got redirected, and I ended up my very first deployment, we deployed to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And that was in October, November, December. Yeah, December, January timeframe of 94. And that period of time, we were dealing with a significant number of both Cuban and Haitian migrants. In fact, we were housing nearly 40,000 on Guantanamo proper.
In a humanitarian setting, but not a, okay.
So, I mean, the issue was that there had been this huge migration, and before they went basically what you call feet dry, that, you know, were intercepted and redirected, and then were being housed and, processed for either repatriation back to their home country or for resettlement into the United States.
Oh, okay.
And so our full regiment was deployed there. We, with the Seabees, which is actually a pretty wild mission right away. We built up massive camps, all across all of Guantanamo, basically tent shelters, built all these. We also built the original Camp X-Ray. I'll tell you about that one in a sec, I guess. and my company, Alpha Company, 13th Engineers time, was responsible for basically security and processing of the migrants through the process with what was then the Immigration and Naturalization Service. So we would take them through medical screenings, we would take them through security screenings, we would transport them back and forth, and then we also had responsibility for what we call the X-ray missions, which were when we had intercepts. Either that meant that we had a boat come ashore, we had a swimmer, we had somebody who tried to cross the border from Cuba into Guantanamo. And then receive them. And so we would receive them, provide care, initial questioning, determine circumstances, and then process them from there. And then we also maintain responsibility for security during repatriation missions, so that we would, you know, take them out of camps and, you know, whether they were going on a flight or on a Coast Guard cutter going back to Haiti or whatever. It was an intriguing mission as a young lieutenant. It gave me an incredible amount of perspective on what freedom and democracy truly means, and the lengths of people will go to do that, to achieve what we have in this country.
Yeah.
That we just, you know, I mean, we can never forget what it is.
Yeah.
To have a democracy. 'Cause I watched, you know, I watched people lose their lives. I watched people sacrifice and lose family members in an effort to gain the dream that we have here in the U.S.
I remember those days as a young kid in the 90s watching CNN and the news of the little flotillas.
Mm-hmm.
Of
That's people exactly what we were dealing with.
Lashing whatever they could together to get out of those island nations and just get to Miami, get to Key West, get to Florida, to the promised land.
Yep. I once watched three men try to run through a minefield from Cuba proper into Guantanamo.
Wow.
The trail one was shot in the back by a Cuban guard. The second one triggered a landmine, which shrapneled the first one. The first one was the only one who survived, and we received him, cared for him. Watching something like that,
yeah,
and thinking, what is it that drives a person to accept a risk to run through a known minefield with somebody firing at you from behind? I mean, is there any more, you know, present a lesson on how valuable freedom is?
For sure. Well, and then what ultimately is the outcome of that first man? You guys obviously care for him.
We care for him, provide treatment.
Do you repatriate back to Cuba?
So it depends. I mean, definitely not an area that we as a military were responsible for. That's what the, you know, INS would do at the time. They would go through and see whether there was security risk, whether, you know, refugee status, et cetera, et cetera. In that individual's case, he required higher level medical care, and we ended up resettling him in the U.S.
Okay. Because, you know, you probably can't send him back after that. Too. It's just like,
yeah,
if they were already firing on you upon your exit, I don't think they receive you back well.
No. Well, so. Yeah, there were some issues with that. We had a number of, there was an operation called Safe Passage where there was a large number of Cubans that were being held in Panama. And, you know, we had some issues there, and they ended up getting moved into Gitmo. And the majority of these individuals were ones back in the day there that Castro had released because they frankly had emptied the prisons.
Yeah.
And you know, we received these guys, basically the U.S. Marshals would fly them to us because that's the way international law worked. They would fly them into Gitmo, and then we would receive them off the aircraft. And these people were hardcore criminals. By and large, they, you know, it was interesting because the Cuban prison system would like tattoo their prisoners, you know, what the crime was. So we understood. You could tell by the, you know, look on the hand that, oh yeah, that guy's a murderer. All right, let's manage this guy. And there was a period in time that we through diplomatic channels coordinated with the Cuban military to transfer them back into Cuban holdings. So we ended up opening a lane through the minefield that existed between Cuba and Gitmo. And we transported a large number of these prisoners after we'd received them. We held them in Camp X-Ray for a period of time. And then we negotiated their return, and we brought them back and gave them to the Cubans and drove away. And who knows what happened.
Yeah. That's so fascinating though. I mean, right now, obviously over the last, you know, handful of years, immigration in the United States is a hot button topic. It's on the tips of everybody's tongues. We hear it in the news daily, but we've been at this for a very long time. The immigration conversation in the 90s, I think sometimes we have a tendency to forget, but like I said, we've been having this conversation for a very long time.
It wasn't as visible because, I mean, the information mediums we have now, you know, I mean, yeah, you saw it some on news, but you didn't have the 24-hour news cycle and the internet and all that. But yeah, we were dealing with huge numbers. But, you know, we were dealing with huge numbers even when I was working and worked in Northcom, and we were dealing with massive numbers of unaccompanied migrants. We even in Cuba, we had a camp that was, we had over 10,000 unaccompanied migrants, because in that time, particularly for the Haitians, they believed that their children would have a greater chance of resettlement if they just came unaccompanied. So they would basically deny that they were their, you know, parents. You know, so we had all these kids, no parents, trying to figure out what to, you know, how to find them a home, get them cared for. It was difficult.
Yeah.
Difficult.
I can imagine. Just the human nature of it. And I think, you know, this is why I'm fascinated with this conversation, is the United States military, if you, on a surface level, war fighting function, you know, defend and protect the nation of the United States. But then there's so many other missions and so many other roles. Humanitarian is huge. And when I look back on my career over 20 years, the humanitarian missions, I have a ton of fondness for and great memories, because I think the goodwill that is the United States Army and military, and we can accomplish so much around the globe when utilized appropriately and well.
I think war is simple compared to some of those humanitarian operations, you know, and a lot of the things that, you know, it's the capability and the values that we as Americans bring, you know, to nations in need, is it's irreplaceable. And I mean, those experiences I value the most. You know, my ability or the opportunity to have been a part of something bigger than me, to help others, you know, pursue some form of quality of life, whatever that may mean for them.
Yeah. Well, and then being a father too. Mm-hmm. What a fortunate life that my daughters were here in Lone Tree, Colorado. Like, we don't have to fight for our existence. We don't have to migrate for our existence to somewhere better. So my daughter and I, my oldest, she's in fifth grade, and every day when I pick her from school, I'm like, okay, what did you learn today at school? And yesterday she told me about how she was learning, you know, they're going through the founding of our nation, why we fought the Revolutionary War, why our founding fathers created those, are the original United States. And I was like, okay, you're telling me what you learn. What do you think? You know, like, why do you think we did this? And so she delved into that, and it was super fun to hear from an 11-year-old the perspective of that's why awesome. We formed the United States. But I think that's the important lesson of the day, was, okay, not just, you know, what did they teach you in class, but like, why do you think America's great? And for 249 years, next year will be 250. Yeah. 249 years, people have fought for this country physically and metaphorically. And I think it's great. And it's a mission that, you know, we obviously don't take lightly when we do our oaths. I've only ever done the oath of enlistment, but I'd imagine the officer oath is pretty similar. You bear true faith and allegiance to the United States and the Constitution. It's such a fun thing to believe in, and it's validated every day you turn on the news of how many people around the globe are just clamoring to get here. Yep. How is the officer oath?
Well, you know, I mean, I think
it's got to be similar, right?
It's very similar. Yeah. I think it's important to emphasize that, you know, our oath is to the Constitution. Yes. You know, it's not to an individual or anything like that. And the requirement as a commissioned officer to uphold those values is at the core of what our nation is. You know, it goes beyond politics. And honestly, that's something that I've always valued immensely. And it's obviously, today's day and age is trying, but I think it's in, you know, the service has got to be unbiased in everything that we do. You know, whether unbiased from politics, unbiased from religion, in order to be effective in what we do.
Yeah.
Because, you know, bias influences decisions. I won't speak on the political aspects of it because I don't want to dive into that.
No.
But I'll give you a perspective just for religion. You know, I mean, for 20 years, you know, we were in conflict and still are to this day to a degree with fundamentalist Islam. If I am overly biased as a Christian, then how can I serve Muslims?
Yeah. Where's your impartiality?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't have that bias. I mean, my bias is towards humanity. You know,
that's a good point. Well, I think when you also swear an oath to the Constitution and to the United States and not politics or any of those other things, it helps carry you through the good times and the bad times, both, because it's not all just humanitarian missions. As your career progresses, you go to war, yeah, and then ultimately leads to your injury. So when you believe in that higher ideal, was that a part of your recovery? And you know, kind of walk me through getting injured during your service on deployment. Like I said earlier when we started this, Purple Heart recipient, you were pretty heavily injured. Did you lean on at any time in your recovery the ideal that is the United States? Like, was that the shining hill, the shining beacon of like, you know, this is going to get me through, this is trying, but at the end of the day, I have great love for this country. Did that ever come up, or was it purely just day to day?
So two parts to that question. I guess I'll go back to the injury, but to immediately answer that question, I'd say no, it wasn't like a shining hill or something. It was assumed.
Okay.
In other words, I mean, I've served my country all my life. And I never had any concern or any fear or any worry because I knew that my country had my back. I knew that the services were there to take care of me in my time of need, and I received great care. And, you know, and to this day, I am 100% combat related, you know, disability, based upon my injuries, yeah, you know, full left arm reconstruction, TBI, all the fun stuff that goes with getting blown up. But the nation has maintained that commitment to me, you know, in return for the sacrifices that I've given in a lifetime of service to this nation.
Cool.
I never questioned that. You know, I hope I never have to. I hope it's always there. I hope, yeah, we maintain the sanctity of that, you know, commitment to our veterans, because without it, you know, without it, our people will lose faith in the nation. So
I've got goosebumps. You just gave me goosebumps. You sign on the dotted line, not with an expectation, but an understanding that at some point things might go wrong. And yeah, that was beautiful. That was a beautiful way to describe that, of like, because you sign on the dotted line and be like, I'm going to serve this nation, they're going to have my back. And we can argue till the cows come home on the role of the VA and whether it's properly staffed and funded, yada, yada, yada. But at the end of the day, the mission statement that is the VA in the United States is, if we're going to send young men and women to war, upon their return, we're going to take care of them.
Yeah. And actually, I'll take it all the way back to your question about, you know, maintaining a team. And I think this also applies. I know that any service member who I am, you know, standing with has taken that very same oath and is risking their own life equally. And because of that, they deserve all of me. You know, they deserve everything I can to ensure that they're trained, they're equipped, they're protected, that they're led the best. You know, that as a leader, it was incumbent upon me because they took that very same oath. You know, they accepted that risk. Sure, the motivations may be different. Maybe they wanted to get money for college. You know, maybe they are seeking a path to citizenship. You know, maybe they're doing this, that, whatever, or following the path of their, you know, family. But it's immaterial. They've signed, yes, that blank check.
Yes.
You know, and a lot of people, you know, anybody, I'm sure many folks who have been injured in combat have been asked this question. They're like, oh, was it worth it? You know, or they'll, you know, comment on the reasons or the rationale behind the war, or now that you're dealing with all this and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, no question. Because I understood what I signed up for. I understood those risks. They're inherent in it. Another day at the office.
Yeah. Well, what was your role when you were injured?
I was injured in, April of 2007. My lab day is coming up on April 22nd, Earth Day. I kind of find that a little amusing, give blood to the earth on Earth Day. I was embedded in the Iraqi Army. I was serving with a military transition team out of the 4th Brigade, 25th ID, Team 820, some great guys, Task Force Warrior, a MIT team, for those who are not familiar with it, kind of offset a lack of capacity that we had with our special operations teams. So, special forces originally is really to train, train foreign forces.
Yes.
Well, we didn't have enough capacity to completely do that with the Iraqi Army. And in our case, our brigade basically established several MIT teams during our deployment in order to meet that requirement. So I was embedded as a maneuver trainer. I was training the headquarters of an Iraqi brigade in two battalions, our teams, a 12-man team, and then a small security component. And we were serving south of Baghdad in the city of Al-Hilla. We were ambushed in an IED strike outright Tampa. I know that many people have been that route, down the south side. And all of us survived. It just kind of took all of us to recreate a full human being at the end of the day, because pieces and parts didn't come home with us. But yeah.
April 2007, I was in Iraq the exact same time, just up north near Mosul. Yeah. So
you remember those years. So.
Few miles from you, but I would have been in country at the exact same time.
Yeah. 06, 07 was that was a tough year. That was a hard deployment.
It seemed there was a lot. There was a lot. And I was standing on the tarmac. I'll never forget it to this day. Standing on the tarmac, putting caskets on C-130s back in the day, in 06, 07, hearing a battalion come to attention while we did that and then present arms, it gives me chills to this day. That's the ultimate sacrifice. Yeah. And I'm grateful, higher power, whatever it may be, looked out for you and your truck and your vehicles that day. Like you said, we lost some limbs and body parts and things like that, but all those lives were spared. So that's heartening to me. But then that takes you back stateside and starts your recovery. I'd imagine that is a pretty arduous, challenging circumstance. I look at you now and your left arm looks pretty dang good. Still pretty good muscle mass. You got your scars, but, regaining function, I'm sure, was quite challenging.
Yeah. You brought thoughts back about the ramp ceremonies, and that is an unbelievably emotional thing. And, I will say that for our brigade that year, we lost 52.
Wow.
I think we're at 77 now as a result of the continuing traumas of war. And we sustained well over 360 wounded during that deployment.
Okay.
And I highlight that because when I redeployed for my wounds, I ended up going to Madigan Army Hospital out in Fort Lewis for the majority of my care. I had a limb salvage. They wanted to amputate, and then got lucky with a civilian surgeon up in Seattle at Harborview, Dr. Doug Hanel, an amazing man who, I don't know what kind of magic he did, but he somehow recreated my arm.
Wow.
So 13 surgeries to rebuild it. And after about 4 months there, went back up to Alaska, to Fort Richardson. And I highlight the number of wounded, and fallen because as I went through that recovery process, we also, for those who aren't familiar, you maintain a rear detachment chain of command within your formations back at base while a unit's deployed. And we had some challenges with the leadership going on in the rear detachment at that time. So my brigade commander at the time, Colonel, General Garrett, had given me he gave me a call on the way back, and he basically said, "Hey, so Hoffmeister, I hear that no one with two arms is good as Hoffmeister with one arm, and I need a rear detachment commander." And I'm like, "Man, sir, how can you ask me something like that and have me ever say no?" So simultaneously with my recovery from my own wounds, I assumed leadership of our rear detachment command, and we had well over 200 wounded at the time.
Okay.
In Alaska. And so kind of the role is to help lead through all the processes that are going on in a unit at home station. So in wartime, that means for this case, it was case management for our wounded. It was training and deploying individuals to backfill our losses. And it was receiving and burying our dead.
Yeah.
Not an easy job to do when, you know, you're dealing with your own
staring you right in the
stuff.
Face.
Yeah. But also at the same time, it gave me a very good perspective because, you know, those individuals that were going through the trauma of their injuries and trying to understand who they were, sometimes people call it, you know, what their new normal is. I was doing it too.
Yeah. My battalion commander's recovering at the same time. I don't know if how to quantify it. Obviously that's unquantifiable, but the impact that probably has,
yeah,
for a junior soldier. As an enlisted guy, you know, I'm sure you had privates, I'm sure you had young specialists, young NCOs who were wounded, but they could look to, what were you at that time, lieutenant colonel?
No, I was a major.
Oh, major.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Yeah, I was a major. Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, you know, you can't pull the wool over your eyes. They can't say, "Oh, but I'm wounded." I'm like, "Yeah, me too."
Yeah, me too, buddy.
I'm like, "Yeah, well, I know that doctor, so," and I don't think he said that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, in some ways that maybe it disadvantaged them because I was right there with them. But I also, you know, was very empathetic because I understood too.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've always kind of, I guess, had a little hard stick in the spine. So to me, it also... what was enabling me to continue to drive was that desire to get back,
okay.
That desire to continue to serve or just get back to whoever I was going to be. That was a driving need for me. And I saw across, you know, our wounded, how that played out because, you know, serious injuries are polarizing. You either devolved into post-trauma or you go find what post-traumatic growth can be.
Mm.
So, you know, you either wallow in it or you rise. And that's a circumstance of your environment, of the people around you, of your own sense of resilience and your willingness to get back out there. So while that was difficult to be in that position, I was blessed. You know, I was blessed to have an incredible woman by my side who, you know, helped me through it and goaded me. And, you know, our shared life experiences up to that point, they played out because it was just another, you know, all right, we're in a low point. We need to ruck up. We need to move.
I love that because not only does the Army need their major back, the Army needs their major back. Your wife needs her husband back.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
So my wife recognized that very clearly because I was definitely dealing with some depression. I couldn't use my arm. It literally took me 4 years before I could make a fist.
Wow.
It's no exaggeration. I had 5 inches of my ulnar nerve replaced. They took a sural nerve out of my leg and implanted it into my arm with what's called a cable graft. My whole ulna is titanium. My elbow bone is like layered plating and screws. It's a pretty cool x-ray actually. But I went from being, you know, a sponsored athlete, a high performing officer doing all of these things to all of a sudden I got one arm.
Mm.
I don't know what I can do. Can I ride a bike? Can I climb? Can I do all these things I used to do? And I questioned it and I just didn't know who I was going to be. You know, we were in Alaska, and before Alaska, we'd lived in Colorado. We'd done a lot of mountaineering and climbing and stuff and climbed a whole bunch of the 14ers out here. And we're like, all right, we're going to be Alaska. We're climbing Denali, no doubt. That was the plan. Then I got wounded. And I remember my wife coming to me one day and she just made the simple statement. She said, "I'm climbing Denali." And it was not an offer, not a suggestion. It was nothing. It was just a statement of fact. Mm. I'm climbing. She's good. She knows me. Because to me, it was a slap in the face. It was a realization that I either need to, you know, continue wallowing in this depression, or I need to step up and go with her. The things that went through my mind immediately were like, yeah, well, I can't feel my arm. I can't use my arm. I'm going to get frostbite and I'm going to lose it, you know, after fighting to regain it. Or I'm going to die because I can't self-arrest with one arm and I fall off the mountain or, you know, whatever. All these just irrational fears.
Well, yeah.
Well, I won't say irrational. I did get frostbite.
but fears.
Fears.
Yeah.
But then the other side of it were the same thing as survivor's guilt. So she's going to go and she's going to climb and, oh, she's going to fall in a crevasse. I'm not going to be there to save her. And, oh,
yeah.
So I just went through this whole slew of those things. And then I'm like, but then I'm not going to have this experience with her. And what does that mean for who we are? So to encapsulate all of that, what that really came down to was I realized, I was like, number one, I'm pretty selfish in all these fears and all this stuff. Yeah, they're normal. They're human. But look, I've got her. I've still got my relative health. I've got the ability to potentially do this. I just got to get after it.
Yeah.
And even if I don't, I'm fine. I've got the education. I've got the experience. I don't need to stay in the military. All these things are going to come together. I'm going to be okay. With or without an arm, I'm fine. But then this is what really hit me at that point. I'm like, yeah, but what about all the people who don't have any of what I just described?
Ooh.
You know, what about the 18-year-old who lost his leg and, you know, maybe and doesn't have a significant other that's going to be with them for, you know, the rest of their life working through those long-term challenges of disability? You know, what about this high-performing special forces guy who suddenly was taken down a notch the same way as I was, trying to find their identity? And so I told her, I'm like, okay, well, we'll climb, but we're going to do it different. We're going to find people who are sucking like me. And I'm not talking physically, I'm talking mentally, who have this gap in their sense of identity. They don't know who they are. They don't know where they're going to be. And they need to rediscover it. And so we created what we called Operation Denali. We went out, we started recruiting other wounded warriors who needed it, not wanted it, needed it to fill that gap. Started raising money, pulled the whole thing together, and brought a bunch of guys up.
When you say needed, how many found you versus how many did you find? Because sometimes when you need something, it's not self-evident and you aren't going to go all in and you can't put yourself in that place yet. Obviously you were in that place and you were starting to have those feelings and you're able to identify that in somebody else. But were people referred to you or were you handpicking these people?
Both. Okay. I did a lot of cold calling. I went out to Walter Reed, Center of the Intrepid, talked to case managers, explained what I was after, advertised it, you know, and I got some calls from guys that I'm just like, I mean, they were amazing. One young man had lost both arms, had barely even enough for a prosthetic attachment, had like never climbed like a hill. I think he'd lived, you know, kind of big city New York kind of thing. And I'm like, yeah, I think you're a little beyond my ability to support you right now. Let me gain some experience.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm like, this is, I got you, but you're not quite there for what I can do for you. Another guy, actually Steve Baskis, who went on to do a bunch of climbing. He's a blind climber. And I wasn't really sure I could handle, you know, the visual guide aspects of it. So that intimidated me. So I screened some people out because of risk. That I wasn't really sure I could, you know, meet
which
their
makes,
need.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
And then, you know, the selection part really was, it was a conversations about trying to figure out why they wanted to do it.
Okay.
You know, and I think the guy I'll talk to the most is about this was, you know, Matt Nyman. And we lost Matt Nyman 2 years ago in a climbing accident up in Alaska. So unfortunate tragedy. But Matt was on a urban assault and mountaineering team on in Delta.
Okay.
And so, you know, don't need to go into details of the unit, but these guys are the elite of the elite.
Yeah.
And he lost his leg and severely damaged his other leg during a raid in Baghdad when his helicopter crashed. And he was thrown through the rotor of the helicopter as it crashed into the top of the target building. So you take a guy like that who basically lived on adrenaline and lived on, you know, max performance, and all of a sudden he's missing a leg. He can't do any of these things, and he's struggling with over-medication. He's struggling with all of these things. That was the kind of guy I was after.
Interesting.
Because then to suddenly to be able to fill that gap with the realization that, okay, well, I can put a snowshoe on my prosthetic and I can still climb, or I can put a crampon on it, or I can put a hard boot and I can do technical climbing. I can do all these things. I just got to look at it different.
Cool.
You know, and yeah, I mean.
Well, then you touched on that. Equipment considerations. I'd imagine, and this is what it's been so fun, and now that I'm serving with Adaptive Adventures, like, this is at the forefront of my mind, just equipment considerations of, yeah. We've seen the 20 years of war and all of our warriors coming back needing prosthetics and all of these other, on all this equipment, but to, like you said, to attach a crampon to a prosthesis, that was probably new. I'm assuming, or, yeah, or like, there did was you not, have to find specialized?
Yeah, there was not a lot of stuff at the time, and it took a lot of creativity and resourcing. You know, some of it existed; it was just cost prohibitive. But yeah, we just had to get creative on a lot of things, and we learned so many things that would seem simple, but you know, the way a prosthetic is attaching to a stump is a big deal. If you know, obviously, it's a big deal whether or not you have a joint. You know, Matt was a below knee amputee. Okay. So the challenges then became less going up, more coming down, because when you're descending and you've built up a bit of sweat in your socket, then you end up creating a little bit of suction. And if you're doing, say, you've got snowshoe and boot and all that stuff, it creates more drag on the prosthetic. So that vacuuming starts creating blistering on the stump. And if you blister on the stump and you're carrying 80 to 100 pounds already, you know, it's a recipe for disaster. So there's a lot of those nuances that were tough.
Yeah.
John Cunningham, who was a Marine captain on the climb with us, he was an Army amputee. He lost his arm in a IED ambush in Haditha. The challenge for him is when you do a lot of technical rope work in high altitude mountaineering, is you, especially if you're using any kind of fixed lines, you're passing ropes. Well, it's hard enough to do with two hands in mittens and all this kind of craziness, trying to pass a carabiner and move your protection and all that stuff. And so John had to figure out he used predominantly a hook for his prosthetic, and he had to gain, you know, a level of skill to pass a knot, not just for him, but for everyone else. Cause it's minus 40 degrees. You're trying to pass a knot. It's not a really fun time to be hanging out, taking 10 minutes to pass a knot every 10 meters.
But again, that team mentality, yeah, the leadership, the trust in your team.
Yeah.
It's just as much as he's leaning on you and everybody else to get up that mountain,
yeah,
you're leaning on him as equally. So
yeah. It was fun bringing repair parts too. We had an extra leg for Matt. I remember we were walking once. We passed this British team, and you know, Matt had just like a cross trainer on his prosthetic, and it's like, it's freezing out, I don't know, minus 20. And this guy looks, he's like, "Oi, mate, aren't you gonna get a frostbite?" He's like, "Nah, it's okay." We walk by and the guy turns around. I was right behind him, and I had his leg strapped on my back, and he looks at my ruck with the leg strapped across the back, and then he looks at Matt. He's like, I get it.
Oh, that's funny. So Denali, 20,320. Wow.
They claim it's growing, so may have to go back.
Whole team summited?
Nope. Only half the team did. Yeah, okay. Which is frankly a normal percentage. Your average success rate's 50 to 55% on Denali. And the reasons were not injury related. So John didn't summit on that one because he ended up coming down with some pulmonary edema.
Okay.
And we had to get him down. And then Matt actually didn't summit because he ended up getting some pretty close to cerebral edema, as best we can determine. He had a sudden drop in his oxygen saturation rate up at 17,000 that necessitated his rapid descent. He went back and with the Heroes Project the next year, he did summit.
Cool. Then
he went on a climb in Mexico and a whole bunch of other places, and it launched him. He was climbing nice. All over the place, and he did exactly what I had hoped every one of us would have been able to do. He led and he inspired other people to continue to climb and pursue their own summit.
Yeah, naturally. I mean, but that's such a catalyst, like grabbing that summit then just sets you on this trajectory from then and there. Was Denali your first first super consequential? Was that your first large summit like that? Like you said, you 14ers in Colorado, but like Denali.
It was, definitely in terms of high altitude where you're talking like, you know, 20,000 feet arena. I won't say it was my first most challenging climb. I spent about 11 hours in a snow cave on Rainier once due to an unexpected snowstorm. So I definitely understood the challenges of glacial mountaineering very personally.
Yeah.
That was the first definite high altitude mountain. And that set us off too. We continued. At the time, I had a goal that we wanted to create an organization that would continue to get other, you know, fellow wounded up and climbing. I was also continuing to serve and then continuing to deploy and everything else. And so it was hard to do both. But the climb of Denali was really, to my knowledge, one of the first ones, the first major climb like that for wounded soldiers. And there were a whole bunch that then trickled after that. Mm. There were several of Rainier, smaller climbs like that. Excuse me. And I interacted with a couple of other organizations, Soldiers to the Summit. Combat Action Program. There were a couple that did very similar climbs. So I worked with them. I was able to take. I had 23 people on my list of climbers that I wanted to get up a mountain. I took 4. And then all the remainder, I just kept passing them and putting them and connecting them into other groups. So I managed to continue to do that. And then I'd also, Gail and I, we worked with Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors. They actually helped sponsor the climb as well. They were near and dear, have always been near and dear. They're an incredible organization. They helped with several of our Gold Star family members. So we got involved with them, and so we brought the fiance of one of our fallen from 425 up Aconcagua. We did a climb of Kilimanjaro to raise money for TAPS. So yeah, just continue to do that.
That's so awesome. Like I started, you know, the podcast Military Mountains Mortgage. Those three things to me are just. I just love them. They're the dominant themes of my life. And so I'm loving this mountain conversation because it's so fun. And it's life. To me, the mountains is the ultimate proving ground. Yes, every mountain is assembled with the same materials, rocks, whatever. But they're all different. They all have their unique challenges, their unique aspects. And so the more you spend time in there, the more you get accustomed to overcoming things just one after another. And the whole impetus for your goal was to, you know, get guys out who've been injured. They're not alone. Although you've got this challenge, it's unique to you, but so many other people are going through a similar thing. Mountains to me are no different, where it's just like, yeah, you spend enough time going over one rise and it's just like, yeah, it might look the same, but it's got its own unique route. And so I think taking wounded warriors and I broadly appealing, and I think broadly this could be applied to the whole civilian population too. It's like, if you're going through some massive traumas and you need to overcome some stuff, injuries, mental, whatever it may be, some time in the mountains really is a healing mechanism. And it seems counterintuitive because the risk is so high. But I think with training and diligent action like you guys were trying to accomplish and good guiding, I think it can be a really good place to heal people.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but, you know, mountains, that's a metaphor. It's a metaphor for life, truly. You know, we always go to the extreme. So this conversation, even people are talking, we're talking about Denali, which is, it's a significant investment physically, financially, everything. But, you know, it doesn't have to be that. You know, I've talked with people in the past about how you define your mountain. You know, and no matter what it is that you're dealing with, it's a matter of what your perspective is. And I'm a big believer about, you know, setting goals. It's what I, you know, it's what we do in my coaching business is we do. It's absolutely essential that you have some type of end goal. And frankly, it should scare you. And frankly, people should know about it because, you know, you're putting your money on the table.
True.
Because what does it do? It forms structure. It forms discipline. It forms commitment. It requires you to take those necessary steps that get you out of your mind and put you on a functional task towards an end state.
Yeah.
So whatever your mountain is, you know, figure it out and go for it. It doesn't have to be Denali. I mean, for some people, especially dealing with severe injury, it may be rolling out to the mailbox. And it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Just set the goal. Go for it.
Nice. I love that. Because, you know, in the outdoor sports industry, there's hierarchies, right? And it's just like, oh, this goal wasn't big enough. And so people can get kind of anxious or they're just like, it wasn't grand enough of an experience. And it's like, I love that concept. What is your mountain? 5K is just fine. Yeah. If that's your mountain and a 5K is how you start, fantastic. Maybe one day you'll run a marathon.
The 5K can be the gateway drug.
Yeah, exactly. and what a healthy gateway drug. Because I've seen it so much in our community where drug abuse, substance abuse, vice abuse, sex, gambling, alcohol. To me, it was alcohol. So it's just, you know, you can have a healthy outlet.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I mean, there's a lot of healthy ways to get your dopamine fix. So,
there is. You know. We're biased. I think a mountain bike is a pretty good one.
Absolutely. Anything with wheels is good to me.
Yeah. A couple years ago, I was just working away. I was just doing mortgage stuff. I was sitting at my computer and you called me and you're like, would you like to come down to Texas and go mountain biking with former U.S. President George W. Bush? And I was like, well, let me call my wife.
It's not a bad out of the blue call.
Yeah. I'm like, what? You know, like you just blew my mind. I'm like, what? I call my wife. Our daughter was going to be a couple weeks old. She was born on October 20th and this would have been right around Veterans Day. So what, 3 weeks later? So we would have had a newborn. I'm like, this is an uncommon request. Mark just called me and asked me this, like, what do you think? And she's just like, when do you get to go mountain biking with a former US president? Yes, of course, go do that. I've got the baby. And I immediately called you back. Yeah, what do we got to do? And so that was a beautiful outpouring of support. And you saw something in me to invite me on that. And that was great. But kind of for everybody listening, you were in the first Bush Warrior ride. And obviously George W. Bush, he was our president on 9/11 and the initiation of the war on terror. Kind of walk me through how you got involved with that first ride. And then ultimately, if you could kind of, what does George mean to you?
Yeah. So I was part of the first ride. It was called the Warrior 100K in 2011. And that was, it was born out of a conversation between a former special forces veteran, Chris Self, who basically cajoled the president into doing some bike riding, and then it broadened into an initiative that the president took to recognize those nonprofit organizations that were investing in our wounded. So several nonprofits were identified and asked to select some wounded warriors to attend the first ride. And I was lucky enough to get picked and join in with several other riders. And since then, it's been history. I've been able to go out and ride with the president multiple different times. It was an incredible experience. But I guess to answer your question about what is it like to ride with the president, the very first ride was pretty amazing because, man, the president can send it.
Yeah, believe it or not,
he's a good rider.
Yeah.
Well, you've seen him on the e-bike. You haven't seen him on the original first rides.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And he definitely, you know, he was a good rider, technical, physical, challenged everybody. It's fun to, you know, shit talk a little with the president. It was an unbelievable experience for us. I don't know. It just felt like family immediately.
Cool.
With him. There was none of these weird, you know, airs or distance. Once we're on the trail, it was just on the trail together, just sharing the moment, sharing the environment, sharing nature. And what I think it's been really valuable is a tool that the Bush Presidential Center has leveraged to identify veterans who are really committing to helping their own fellow veterans with either through veteran service organizations or through other means, their leaders in that community, you know, like you. That's why I've picked you. Because it's, you know, it's incumbent upon those of us who are in a position to help our fellow veterans to do so. And anything that can contribute or advance that goal is important. And the Bush Center has done the heavy lifting in order to create that venue and to create a network of leaders and what we call Team 43 to continue to do that and pay it forward.
Yeah. It's such a good use of those funds, that gravitas, you know, like not every organization has the leverage of a prior US president behind them, you know? And so going down there and arriving on the ranch and just over the course of all of those days, seeing how George and Laura have devoted their lives to veterans. And it was a heavy experience. You know, going there, I was just kind of reflecting the whole way there, the bus out to the ranch. And I'm just thinking about this. I'm like, I can't even begin to wonder what it's like being the commander in chief of the U.S. Armed Forces at war, and so many soldiers such as yourself are coming back with catastrophic injuries. I'm like, that's got to weigh heavy on your heart. And so me as somebody who hasn't sustained a catastrophic injury, I kind of felt like an imposter when I got off that bus. I'm like, why am I here? Like, there is all these injuries. There's Navy SEALs. There's CIA guys. There's FBI guys. And I'm just like, I'm not these guys. Like, why am I here? And I just really started to contemplate it all. And then I really learned from him over that weekend of just the humility that is just putting yourself out there in service of other people and other veterans. And it seems like that's their thing now. And it jazzes me up to see it, where it's just like, this president and his wife are devoted to our community. It's like the clouds part. And it's just like, yeah, you want to serve your community. But that weekend kind of really reaffirmed it for me, that it's just like, you're just of service to your fellow man, however you can do that. And it's not a comparison of this person's injury over there, or that person's resume over here. It was just, like you said, a family got together, rode bikes, ate barbecue, and shot the shit. You know, it was so fun.
Yeah, I think it's important to, you know, recognize, doesn't matter who you are, there is, you know, we all have a sense of humanity. You know, I don't want to insinuate that there is any form of sense of guilt that the president had to bring us
yeah,
out
of
there.
Course, yeah.
That's not what it was about. What it's about was recognition of our willingness to sacrifice in pursuit of our nation's goals. And I applaud him for doing that. And I truly value his ability to kind of let down airs and, you know, stand shoulder to shoulder with us. Because at the end of the day, we're all people. End of the day, we all had different roles. But it didn't matter where you fit in that pecking order. You were still essential to what, you know, what we've done, as a nation. And, you know, it's interesting that you make the comment because about, you know, the comparison and this imposter syndrome, because, you know, that so many people have that. And you talk about the visible versus the invisible wounds, which is an important conversation.
Yeah.
You know, I can make my wounds invisible very easy. I just wear a long shirt. Nobody knows it. But there is such this, I don't even know how to describe it. There's this, all right, if you're missing a limb, then it puts you in like some kind of a different category because you have this visible injury that solicits a degree of sympathy or whatever. And it's false. Nobody knows, you know, the psychological trauma that you've gone through, whether that's personal or sense of identity issues from the loss, or it's issues of grief or trauma for things that you've witnessed or people that you've lost. Nobody knows that. Nobody needs to necessarily know that. They just need to be open to what your needs are. You know, just to kind of have that level interaction of just being brothers and sisters. And that's what we get, you know, in Team 43.
Yeah.
We've all been there. We've all seen the shit. We've all, you know, had these experiences. Yeah. There's no way you can compare it. Any one individual's experiences. You know, I often laugh because people will be like, "Oh, he had like 6 deployments." I'm like, "Okay, he had like 6 3-month deployments. I had 3 15-month deployments. Is there a comparison? Is it a math problem?"
Yeah.
You know, and then what's the context of the deployment?
Yeah.
You know, was he on a special operations team doing HVTs every other night? You know, and on this constant grueling cycle where they never came off an adrenaline high, or were they spending more time in the defac? Nobody knows what goes into it to make the comparison. But even in a deployment that maybe it was a 15-month deployment with, you know, no time outside the wire, well, that one day that rocket hit that, you know, living container right next to you and did whatever it did and you had to survive that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
No, I love what you're saying because it's a fool's errand trying to go down that comparison path. Obviously, we know the term comparison is the thief of happiness. But just like trying to compare deployments, it's bravado. It's like everybody has got a grander, more crazy deployment story than the next person. But you're going down the wrong path when trying to do that. I think the right path is just the humility of the service. We've all got, you know, everybody's got a crazy story. We've got beautiful stories. Like when I look back on the deployments, a lot of the really fond memories I have are just bullshitting with the guys and stupid stories.
Cigars on the roof.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's part of the whole story, because obviously there's combat, there's wounds, there's direct fire, indirect fire from the IEDs and, you know, rocket attacks and all those things. But at the end of the day, it's just this grand adventure, and it's this incredible story. And I feel like George Bush, I mean, he's got to be one of the most disarming and charismatic men I've ever encountered. The way he disarms you with humor, it's like every single conversation, he's just cracking jokes, and he just, whatever guards you have, you know, whatever things you have up, it just all falls away. Like I said, he disarms you, and he truly is a charismatic person. And you know, for all the media and people out in the world who are like, "Oh, George Bush is this bumbling guy. He's brilliant." And I don't, you know, you don't have to take my word for it, but like, I think he was a very, very charismatic man.
Yeah. No, he's very unassuming, and he is constantly aware of every angle.
Yeah.
And he's usually setting you up if you don't realize it.
Yeah. But then just, you know, the painting, you know, shout out to Leslie and all of our friends from Team 43 who have had the honor of being painted, have their portraits painted by him. I'll be deploying later this year, and Leslie sent me a package that I'll give the girls. You know, she's got that side organization of, you know, the care packages for the children. Super cool. And at the end of that weekend, I was just like, man, I'm only scratching the surface on giving back. There are people who are another level of giving themselves to our community. And I'm just like, I can do more. And I just got to figure out how to do more.
So that right there means that weekend was a success, because that's what it's about, you know. And I will go there for the comparison others, because that's good. That's the kind of comparison we want. Man, I want to be like Leslie Zimmerman.
Yeah.
She doesn't think she gives, but my God, she is an incredibly giving veteran who just continues to pay things forward.
Yeah.
You know, so unbelievably humble, but continuing to impact people's lives in the smallest ways. You're there too. And I think that's important, to find that inspiration, that motivation from others that motivate you to give more, because it makes our community that much better.
Yeah. And I think probably that's the byproduct of everybody's incredible service. It's just like, I'm inspired by you. I think what it was is, you know, like when you're sharing a meal with a Navy SEAL, I'm like, I admire you, but you're inspiring me, you know. And it was so fun. And so for that, all that to say, I'm eternally grateful to you for exposing me to that. And, like, however I can pay it forward, I'll keep working on that.
That's the plan. Keep paying.
Keep working on it. I finish every podcast with these two questions. We've touched on it, and I have no idea what you're going to say. What has been your greatest challenge that you've overcome?
I'm still working my way through it. Becoming a good civilian. Transition is a tough time.
Okay.
And I think it was more difficult than I expected. Of course, I served for 34 years, longer than I was out of service, I was in service. And so when you make a transition from military to civilian and you shed that complete sense of identity, that sense of family, that full environment, and then immerse yourself in a completely foreign world, it's tough.
Okay.
And I think a lot of us struggle with it, because we don't understand that our identity is so much more than our service, and that, you know, we struggle to find inspiration in pursuing our passions, and it takes time. You know, throughout the service, I'm on active duty. You're either deploying or you're PCSing every 2 years. It's a constant change. All of a sudden, you have time.
Yeah.
You know, you're in one location. I'm living near my kids for the first time in 30 years. And it's amazing. I have so much to be thankful for. But you still have this deep-rooted, like, unrest, because I don't feel like I'm fully doing everything that I can do yet, but I'm growing it, you know? Cool. I mean, we didn't talk much about it, but so I get out of the Army. A lot of people, they go off, they work as defense contractors, they do all these things. I decided I was going to pursue the things that I'm actually passionate about. And I love being able to impact people at a visceral level, help shape them achieve their goals. So what do? I'm a multi-sport coach and I'm a bicycle mechanic. You know, start two small businesses, and I do them more out of service to others than because I need to have a business.
That's awesome.
These are the things I love to give. And so yeah, that's been hard. But I'm loving it.
That's so cool. Well, yeah, I mean, that's why I love challenge. It's like every challenge has a different response to it. And you just have this through line of service in your life. And you know, for the listener, a Fulbright colonel, you were a step below one-star general. And like you said earlier, commanded 4,000 troops. So that's no small transition. that's a heck of a transition into the civilian world.
I don't know. Leading 4,000 people is easier than leading yourself.
Ooh, good point. It is. It's tough. And then my final question, it's the most profound thing anybody's ever asked me. And I think about it daily. And so that's why I asked this question. Who do you want to be? Who does Mark Hoffmeister want to be?
I want to be the man that my wife and my kids see.
Cool.
I want to be what they, you know, what they need, and what they want. And I just want to ensure that whatever I do in this world, that it reflects well, and that it empowers them to have the life they deserve.
Fantastic. It's the best reason to do anything, right? Like our wives and our kids. Well, Mark, man, I was telling Katie before we went hot today, I was just like, I'm fired up. I'm jazzed up. Like, I was so looking forward to sitting with you here for an hour and a half and just having a good conversation. And like I started with, I have a great deep admiration for you. As an enlisted man, you can be my brigade commander anytime.
So. I wish I had the privilege and the opportunity to do that. So thank you, Brian.
Yeah.
And thanks for doing what you do and continuing to lead in the way that you do.
Thank you. Well, yeah, I'll leave it at that. I was going to say something else, but no, that was perfect. Mark, have a good rest of your day, man.
All right, thanks.